NTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, June the 7th. It's going to be a cloudy day today with mild temperatures, a high reaching 66. Right now, wind from the northwest at 13. Pretty much a gray sky. 55 degrees, Racine and Kenosha. It is 54 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the northwest at 13. 10 past 8 for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show because we're going to be talking about a fascinating book that examines something that now we take completely for granted. But once upon a time, it marked something of a revolution. In the words of the author Scott Woolley in his book, The Network, we're talking about a new revolution at hand that would vastly increase the value of the invisible waves in the air. This revolution came early in the 20th century when we began to understand that we could send signals not just through cables, but over the air via invisible sound waves. And this was a breakthrough which marked the creation of both radio and ultimately television. And there were two great geniuses at the heart of this development. First, an inventor by the name of Edwin Armstrong, and then a gentleman by the name of David Sarnoff, who was really responsible more than any other single person for implementing these new technologies in extraordinary ways. But it was ultimately a battle between the two of them for, in a sense, primacy, for control over this new technology and how it would emerge. And particularly when a new technology of FM radio was developed by Mr. Armstrong, which threatened to unseat AM radio, which was already in place. This really, in a sense, finally doomed what had been a friendship, maybe an increasingly uneasy friendship between these two geniuses. Hence this fascinating book called The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. The author is Scott Woolley, who has written extensively for a number of different magazines and journals like Fortune and Slate and Forbes, and he is responsible for this fascinating new book, which is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, again called The Network. Scott Woolley, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Glad to be talking to you. I especially enjoy books that explore technologies that now are so much a part of everyday life, every moment of our lives, that we completely take them for granted. Talk for a moment about both the challenge and the pleasure of examining something like the emergence of these new technologies that we read about in The Network.
Well, it is this fascinating combination of these electromagnetic waves that carry all this information, being invisible. They're always around us, and yet they're unseen. As you say, we just ignore them. and yet they're constantly becoming more powerful. And one of the ways I got into this story is I was covering the modern wireless technology, and you think about what's happened with the power of the airwaves and what your smartphone can do today versus a decade ago when you probably didn't have a smartphone. This pace of wireless technology advance seems astounding. And yet when you go back and look 100 years ago when people first started to try to master these waves and control these waves, the leaps in progress were even greater and more mind-bending for people. I mean, some of the things your iPhone 6 can do are certainly certainly amazing, the way it can track you and do all these other things. But 100 years ago when David Sarnoff and Edwin Armstrong first became friends, the mere ability to send a message at the speed of light 100 miles and have someone receive a little text message, before there was the radio as we know it, there was the radio telegraph. And that was, it seemed like magic. I mean, you can only imagine at the beginning of the 20th century, the ability to communicate instantly with people on the other side of the planet didn't seem, you know, like anything that would ever be possible.
Hmm. And I think one of the best things you do in your book, even though, in a sense, your book isn't primarily about this, but you really help us understand the sense of wonder that that was generated by this technology that now seems entirely ancient, of undersea cables through which one could send these signals, for instance, across the Atlantic. That was such a wondrous thing in and of itself, and it means that it's little wonder that there were plenty of people who were perfectly complacent, perfectly satisfied with that being the means of communication over vast distances. And it really took someone of enormous vision to realize that, as wondrous as that was, there was something even more wondrous waiting just around the corner, but as yet unseen.
Yes, I didn't know much about the sort of undersea telegraph cables that were kind of the first World Wide Web. They used to call it the nervous system of the British Empire. The ability to communicate across oceans with these cables was a huge advantage to the British and stock traders at the beginning. There were flash boys. The Michael Lewis idea of stock trading, there was the sort of 1900 version of that. So these cables were incredibly valuable and powerful, and then along comes people like Sarnoff and Marconi and Armstrong with this idea of building a worldwide web of waves in the air and communicating around the globe wirelessly. And so that turned into this huge fight, and there's a fascinating parallel today with Elon Musk has come out with this proposal to replace all the fiber optic cables that now run under the oceans with lasers in space shot between satellites. And so this is one of Elon Musk's many amazing and remarkable ideas. But it's neat that the fight goes on between whether we're going to be sending our information around the world through wires under the ocean or waves in the air. But the 1900 version of this fight I knew nothing about, and really led to the birth of this relationship between Armstrong and Sarnoff.
Right. Mr. Sarnoff actually goes to work for the Marconi Wireless Cable Company after the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company after having worked at the Commercial Cable Company. We should just say a quick word about this intriguing gentleman named Marconi and what prompted him to explore this notion of wireless communication and the kind of hurdles which he had to surmount.
Well, I really came to a different conclusion about a few of the characters in the book as opposed to their general historical reputation. Marconi is often billed as the father of radio, the guy who invented radio, and he does have this famous moment in 1901 where he's in Canada, and he says he receives the first wireless message from across the ocean. And that becomes a big controversy because Thomas Edison doesn't believe him and basically calls him a liar. But then he manages to convince everybody. And what he really does in this sort of, in his Marconi's real talent, was getting people on board, raising a lot of money, and then hiring a lot of other scientists who could make the technology work. So he's a fascinating character, and he's a half charlatan, half business genius. So that and an absolutely critical figure to the birth of the wireless industry.
Absolutely. Just say a quick word about why there is a chapter in your book devoted to the Titanic. How does the Titanic and the sinking of the Titanic figure in this story? It's interesting.
Sure. Well, so in 1912, the 1914, excuse me, the wireless telegraph existed, but it was sort of seen as a joke because the regular telegraph was always better. And so when people believed, oh, okay, you can send messages a couple hundred miles through the air, but who cares? It's not really good for anything. Then along comes the Titanic, and there are two Marconi operators on the Titanic, and as it starts to sink, they send out an emergency message, which is why the Carpathia manages to show up and save 700 people. So in the midst of this, huge tragedy, all of a sudden, Marconi himself and his company become heroes. It's the one bright spot, and wireless technology, wireless communications, goes from being seen as sort of a joke or a parlor trick to this critical power that mankind can use in situations like this. So the Titanic, and the Marconi company, by the way, was almost about to go bankrupt, or the American Marconi company was struggling to raise money. So it comes at this perfect time for Marconi and really establishes the airwaves as a powerful and important tool for humanity.
As you write, as soon as word of the Marconi operator's role in summoning the Carpathia to the Titanic reached New York, the grief-stricken city embraced Guglielmo Marconi as a hero. The power and value of the airwaves had been seared into the minds of the nation. So it's really at this point in the book, the second portion, which you title Invaluable, that we first see Richard Sarnoff and Edwin Armstrong joining forces, in a sense, to at least initially, to rescue a portion of Marconi's company. What was the problem, in a sense, that they were going to try to solve?
Well, the problem was that Marconi, in 1901, when he said he'd sent a message across the Atlantic, was almost certainly lying, because the technology certainly didn't work. And so he claimed he'd heard one letter come in from across the ocean. So he, based on that, said he was going to put all the transatlantic telegraph cables out of business. So 13 years later, he still hadn't done it, because the technology, in fact, did not work. And what Armstrong invents is the vacuum tube amplifier that was able to take these weak airwaves from across the ocean and multiply their power by a thousandfold or more. And all of a sudden, that really makes radio possible. And it makes the idea of going into competition with the transatlantic cables possible. That's the first very valuable wireless business. So it's this key invention that this unknown 22-year-old in New York makes. And then, because nobody believes it's possible, one of the only people who's willing to give it a shot is David Sarnoff. So he hooks up this deal to go down to the Marconi's big antenna in New Jersey. And so he and this unknown inventor go down there one night, and they have this magical moment where they connect this vacuum tube amplifier to these big antennas, and all of a sudden, for the first time, they hear clear as a bell telegraph messages streaming in from Germany and Hawaii. They're in New Jersey, so basically the entire planet. And these two friends, for the first time, and they're the first people in the world to really fully understand the power of the airwaves to connect the world.
One of the things that's quite intriguing is when you tell the story of how Guglielmo Marconi himself, for as anxious as he had to be for some kind of a breakthrough like this to occur, was at least initially quite dismissive of what they were claiming to have achieved.
It's funny, and yes, one of Sarnoff's real talents was that he never stopped expecting to be surprised. Marconi had gotten to this point where he had convinced the world that the things they thought were not possible about sending short-range wireless messages were possible. But then when along comes this news of another amazing breakthrough, he refuses to believe it. They don't buy the patent, and it causes them all sorts of problems. But Sarnoff's real genius was not only to believe Armstrong, but after that to continue to believe that scientists would stun the world by finding new ways to tap the power of the airwaves. And so Marconi's big mistake was not thinking that somebody else could also come up with an amazing advance like he had. Or at least that he had claimed.
Right. It's very interesting to hear about some of what occurs during the First World War to maybe inch some of this new technology along. But at one point, you stop to talk about the patent system, and you make some really interesting and somewhat surprising observations about that, and about the fact that at least at this point in time, the patent system, the way it was set up, it was intended to, in a sense, encourage progress and development of new technologies. But in fact, the patent system was paralyzing these new technologies and preventing them from moving forward. Just say a quick word about what the problem was.
Sure. Well, thank you. It's nice of you to say that I made it interesting, because God knows the patent system is not inherently interesting.
True.
But for these guys, it was the key. And they were going with this, the system from the 1800s about when somebody invented something and you got a patent on it, that was pretty much the whole product. AM radio, the wireless telegraph, even before that, there were hundreds of individual patents that went into the system of antennas and transmitters and receivers. And as a result, lots of different people basically could put up a roadblock to any successful system. So World War I rolls around, and all of a sudden the U.S. Navy starts to take an interest, and they see this problem. They see that different people, different inventors fighting over credit and patents has paralyzed the progress of wireless. So they come in and, using their wartime powers, basically make all the patents void, tell people to build whatever they want, don't worry about the patents, and as a result, for the first time, the wireless telegraph really becomes this effective technology, because you can use Armstrong's amplifier, you can use a bunch of other smaller inventions and put them all together. And this was a lesson that David Sarnoff really saw, because he was involved in that fight during World War I, and he realized you can't let the patent system allow individual inventors to just stop things until they get what they want, because all the individual inventors naturally think that they're the most important and that their invention is the most important. So you need a system, and that's where RCA came from. The Radio Corporation of America was created to replace the Marconi Company. The Marconi Company was a British company, was forced to sell and create this American company, the Radio Corporation of America. And the point was that it would own all the patents, and then it would license them as a group to other manufacturers and surmount this problem of, multiple patents paralyzing progress.
We're speaking with Scott Woolley about his book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. We probably should make sure that people understand that at this point in time, when this new wireless technology is taking hold, it's still primarily thought of, at least by most people who thought about it at all, as a wireless means for one-to-one communication. We're not yet talking about broadcasting. That is sort of the next horizon, which most people can't even conceive of. Tell our listeners about a certain boxing match between Dempsey and Carpentier that helps propel us into this new era.
Sure. It was funny to me to go back, and you would read things that, say, the phone company AT&T would say about wireless technology, and they just naturally assumed it would try to replace the telephone, and it wouldn't do a very good job because it would be more sort of expensive and complex if for two people talking to each other. And Sarnoff, among other people, saw the real power was creating cheaper communication channels, and if those channels had to be one-way channels, so people couldn't talk back, that was very effective for things like this boxing match. So in 1921, right after World War I, the American heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey got it was called the fight of the century. It was the first real fight of the century against the European heavyweight champion, Georges Carpentier. And so they got together in this, they built a giant stadium in New Jersey, and David Sarnoff arranged to have it broadcast to most of the eastern seaboard. And there was this problem with the idea of radio. Until you had radio stations, who was going to buy radio receivers? And until a bunch of people had radio receivers, who was going to build a radio station? So he used this prize fight that people were just obsessed with to get people into concert halls and movie theaters, and little amateurs would set up receivers and broadcast to the concert hall, and it was the first demonstration of the power of broadcasting. So much like the Titanic proved the value of emergency communication, this prize fight that people were so passionate about really proved the power of distributing information one way, broadcasting information. That broadcasting was a farming term describing how you would sow seeds by throwing them all out in the field, and that's, nobody really knew it. And then after this fight, all of a sudden people realized broadcasting could have a much more important meaning.
Right. And I know what you mean. I love a quote you give us from AT&T's Theodore Vail, who's kind of talking about how, in his mind, this wireless technology, it doesn't make any sense compared to the technology that they were using with cables when it came to people communicating with one another. You say AT&T's Theodore Vail pointed out telephone wires possessed immutable advantages over the waves traveling through the air. When a wireless message blasted out of a radio transmitter, its waves headed every which way. The waves that happened to reach a distant telephone receiver represented a minute fraction of the total energy emitted by the transmitter, the rest going to waste as it spread out over vast areas, unnoticed and unvalued. Vail declared that the airwaves were therefore inherently inefficient compared with his network of wires on the ground, and lacked privacy to boot. A wireless telephone talk is a talk upon the housetops with the whole world for an audience. And Theodore Vail fails to understand that even in his own words, he's actually describing a spectacular new world that almost nobody has any idea can exist, except for Sarnoff and Armstrong.
Yeah, and Theodore Vail, to his credit, was a brilliant guy who really understood a lot about the way this technology worked. But then for him to be that blind to this new application is astounding. I mean, it's not just your average guy who misses it. This is one of the smartest guys in the history of communication, and he just doesn't see it.
Well, your book goes on, of course, to describe the establishment of this new technology of radio broadcasting, and we learn a lot, among other things, about the importance of Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover in sort of regulating this exploding new industry. And it's quite interesting to hear not only about that, but also about the sense of corruption that is part of this industry almost from the beginning.
Well, it was really remarkable to me was the effectiveness with which people throughout the ages found a way to turn these airwaves into sort of private wealth. And if you think about, and this was Hoover's thing at the time, there was in the wake of Teapot Dome, was this big scandal where government oil fields were basically sold for much less than they were worth, and bribes taken in exchange. And that's the kind of classic corruption. You sell, you give away something, government property, and get something in exchange. Well, if it's an oil field, people can kind of get their head around it, what that means. When it's the airwaves and you're giving away the airwaves, it's much harder for ordinary people to see the fraud and to see the illicit enrichment of people. But people in the industry quickly realized, hey, these airwaves are worth a lot, and by the way, the government's giving them away for free.
Ultimately, of course, what leads to a terrible rupture between the relationship and friendship of Sarnoff and Armstrong comes over this matter of AM versus FM. Explain why something like FM needed to be developed and what a threat it posed as far as Sarnoff was concerned.
Well, this was really the subject at the core of their debate. And so just before Christmas of 1933, Armstrong, who was a professor at Columbia University, stops by Rockefeller Center, where David Sarnoff has just established as RCA and NBC's headquarters, and they drive up to Columbia to look at this new invention, and it's FM radio. And at the time, they were both a little unclear about the full import of this. It was the first of what we now call broadband communications. Without getting too deep in the weeds of the technology, you know, FM uses a wide range of wavelengths, whereas AM, the idea was always, let's try to get a single wavelength and just encode the human voice onto that. So Armstrong took a radically different view, and he realized you could send more information by using broadband technology. And so he shows this to Sarnoff, and Sarnoff is impressed, but also in some ways not impressed, because it's just a better form of radio. And Sarnoff at the time was really captivated by television. So the idea that you could have radio stations that sounded better and were cheaper to run was interesting, but not to him nearly as intriguing as television. So the two friends sort of split over this issue, and then Armstrong increasingly came to believe that the reason Sarnoff was doing it was not because he was more interested in television, but was simply because RCA and NBC were now the dominant forces in the AM radio business, and he believed that Sarnoff just was afraid of FM.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, what ensues from there is a long, protracted, bitter legal battle between the two of them that is not resolved at all in Armstrong's favor. And we're left with this unsettling sense of just how sour things can turn when they begin with such great promise. What do you think the most important takeaway is from the story of Sarnoff and Armstrong?
Well, the story as I had sort of come upon it was typically told from Armstrong's perspective, that, you know, here was this inventor who wasn't that business savvy, and he was really taken advantage of by a self-interested businessman, David Sarnoff. And I think the truth is far more complex. And what Armstrong really needed to understand, and what Sarnoff told him specifically several times but didn't really resonate, was that simply building a better technology was not the end of the story. You had to think strategically as an inventor about how, you know, private business was going to use this and how the government regulators would accept this. And if you just declared the technology better and then expected it to take over the world, you would lose. And you had to be more strategic. You had to be more political. And so while Armstrong always blamed Sarnoff for all of his problems, the book really sets up as an alternative villain this idea that Armstrong didn't actually know who his real enemies were. That, yes, there were a lot of forces in AM radio who wanted to kill FM. And, yes, there were a lot of forces in the government who conspired to kill FM, and we can get into some of that because they really did cripple it for three decades. But Armstrong personalized it. He made it about this friendship. He made it about his own sense of betrayal. And brilliant as he was as a scientist, he never really had a good grasp of the economic and political forces that really determined his fate.
Scott Woolley's fascinating book is called The Network. The time is 8:39. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about one of the world's most beautiful and mysterious objects, the Hope Diamond. Not the world's largest diamond, but one of its most beautiful and one of its most intriguing. My guest is Richard Curran, who is the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian, where the Hope Diamond is housed. He has written several other interesting books, including The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects and Reflections of a Cultural Broker, A View from the Smithsonian. This book we'll be talking about today, published by the Smithsonian, is called The Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem.
Explain to our listeners why someone at the Smithsonian is writing an extensive history of the Hope Diamond.
Well, because the Hope Diamond, interestingly enough, is, of course, at the Smithsonian. It's the center of our national gem collection. It has a very special place, and it is the most visited object in any museum on the planet.
Really?
Some 4 million to 5 million people every year come to the museum to look at that diamond. And, of course, when it was acquired in 1958, donated to the Smithsonian by famed diamond merchant Harry Winston, many Americans wrote to the Smithsonian and said, don't take it, this diamond is cursed, and if the U.S. takes it, then our country will be cursed. So I found it very fascinating to work here.
Absolutely. We're talking about a beautiful diamond, but also one which is maybe a little smaller than people might imagine. I think someplace in the book you liken it to the size of a walnut.
And it's a good-sized walnut, a thick walnut.
Right. Well, and that's a good-sized diamond, but I mean... Yeah. Compared, for instance, to the picture on the cover of your book, we're not talking about something that's quite as huge as that.
No, in fact, when we interview people that come to the Smithsonian and before they've seen the Hope Diamond, they kind of think it's the size of about a softball.
Right.
And then they think it's about the size of a baseball sometimes. And it's surprising, again, how small it is given its reputation, its fame, and infamy. But indeed, a 45.5 carat diamond is a pretty big chunk of stone.
Hmm. One of the things you've done here is done to the best of your ability or anyone's ability to trace, in effect, the factual history of the Hope Diamond, but along with it, trying to trace the roots of this really extraordinary legend which has sprung up around it, the story of the curse of the Hope Diamond. And really, we get the sense that... That the story of that curse is a relatively recent phenomenon from maybe about 100 years ago or so.
Well, that's true. And, what I try to do in the book is really look at this object because it is traceable over, about a 350-year history as it moves across the planet from India to France to England to the United States. And so it's almost like a biography of an object that's lived for a long time and touched... everybody from Marie Antoinette to the various first ladies of the United States getting involved to being implicated with, jewelers and national collections and so on. So it has a very, very rich biography. But the curse, as told, really comes along at the beginning of the 1900s, very relatively late in its biography, but it does take hold. And it's immediately attributed an ancient origin, but it was really used as a ploy by Cartier, the jewelers Cartier, to sell the diamond to a very wealthy American at the turn of the 20th century, early 1900s.
Hmm. You describe that transaction where the Hope Diamond was unveiled for this... a wealthy woman, and that initial transaction didn't really take hold, but I guess eventually it did. But you talk about how the tale that Cartier spun about the Hope Diamond and of the misfortune which had befallen so many who had owned it. You said Cartier's tale had all the characteristics of a legend. It was regarded as a long-lived tale, widely known and passed down over time. It purported to be factual, but self-referentially admitted that some of those facts might seem fantastic and even fictional. Given the personalities, it was endowed with special significance. Indeed, it became instant folklore early in the era of modern mass communication. What a fascinating concept, that of instant folklore. I mean, it's a contradiction in terms, of course, and yet here it is.
Yeah, well, I think you can look at other kinds of things of the era. Cartier told this story of how it had been stolen from the eye of an idol of India, brought back to the West, and immediately, caused It was implicated in the French Revolution, later in the Turkish and Russian revolutions, had brought misfortune to various owners, divorce, bankruptcy, and death. And so it was a very compelling tale. And the person he was telling this to was Evelyn Walsh McLean and her husband Ned McLean. They owned the Washington Post. Good friends of Florence Harding, who was later to become First Lady of the United States. This acquired a certain characteristic at the end of the Gilded Age. It had a lot in common, if you think about it, with the curse of the Titanic and the curse later, about 10 years later, of the of Tutankhamun. And that is, it resonated with the idea that there was, because of basically disparities of wealth in the United States, and because of the relationship between the West and the East, basically colonialism, that the curse of the diamond was payback. And it was payback for rich folks stealing the money or getting the money from poor folks. Or it was payback for the West robbing the East of its treasures. And somehow that resonated at the time. There was a good bit of resentment against folks that, you know, would put diamonds around the necks of their dogs and parade them while other poor people didn't have enough to eat or didn't have jobs. And so the curse, you know, in a sense, it was a made-up story, but it was true in the sense that it resonated with deep-seated feelings, almost, if you will, of class warfare, or the idea that, as one very wealthy American at the time said, you know, God gave me my money. And the idea that appealed to people with the curse is, so you think God gave you your money. Wouldn't it be interesting if another God took it away?
We're speaking with Richard Curran about his book called Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem. One thing that we probably need to talk about right off the bat is that what we know now as the Hope Diamond, we think, trace its history all the way back to when and even where this gem was unearthed. But in fact, there is an interruption in that history. The sense I get is that we can't maybe be absolutely certain, but it's a very good probability that the long history that you have traced is of indeed the same gem, which undergoes some alterations over the year. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're pretty, you know, we're about 99% sure that we can trace the diamond to its origins. There's a French trader, Jean-Baptiste Tavernier, who goes to India in the 1600s, and pretty sure that he acquires this diamond that was called the Tavernier Violet. He basically held it for a number of years and brought it back to France. But it was 112 carats, and he acquired it in India. And the records of him taking it back, selling it to French King Louis XIV are pretty good. And recent experiments at the Smithsonian pretty much show that our cut-down Hope Diamond, which is now 44 carats, is traceable to a French diamond known as the French Blue that was 67 carats, that's traceable back to this Tavernier Violet diamond that was 112 carats. So the lineage is pretty clear, but again, there's always a little bit of doubt.
When he acquires this first great diamond, it is apparently 112 carats.
Yes.
And maybe we should talk at this moment about what diamonds look like when they come out of the earth. And maybe back then, we're talking about the mid-17th century, even at their best, so to speak, at the most polished, what a diamond would look like back in those days.
Well, you know, I actually tried to, you know, track down, and did, track Tavernier's, you know, footsteps back to the diamond mine, the particular diamond mine at which he acquired this blue diamond that later became the Hope. And, you know, when you're in that area in India, you know, I was looking on the ground to see if something, you know, would shine and I could find diamonds in the rough. The truth of the matter is that diamonds don't really shine and sparkle the way we're used to seeing them in diamond rings. They really have to be cut in a certain way to do that. Diamonds in the rough, you know, can very much be taken as quartz or roughly cut glass. And the Indians, when Tavernier discovered this blue diamond, India was really the only source of diamonds known in the world. and particularly big ones. And the Indians classified diamonds as male and female and neuter. They associated diamonds with different gods and castes. And the Indians thought that diamonds were really protection, almost creating a force field against bad effects. And so they did not cut them in geometric ways that we later did in Europe. So diamonds in the rough are a far cry from what we see on people's rings. Mm.
This diamond trade with which Tavernier was a participant was actually part of an even wider scope form of commerce, which he was also part of what you call mercantile globalism, and especially a trafficking transcontinentally in luxury goods of all kinds. Although we get the sense that diamonds were something sort of exceptionally special in this field.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's remarkable. We're used to globalization now, where we think of products and information going around the globe. But globalization, certainly in this scale and the extensiveness, is rather new. But even going back to the 1600s, you had people like Tavernier, who there he is in India and in Ceylon at the time, and he's saying, you know, the price of those South African emeralds are depressing, you know, the luxury stone market in India. So here he is in the 1600s worrying about South African emeralds undercutting the price of emeralds from Ceylon. I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
And
thinking,
you know,
about the world in those terms that long ago.
Yeah, and you know, again, one of the things that he had to do is think about the notion of how you recorded the weight, the size, and the value of diamonds, because diamonds were implicated in, you know, exchange rates. How many francs for a diamond in Indian rupees and Indian currency? And so all these calculations that we're used to looking at exchange rates in the financial pages of our newspapers or on the net, you had Tavernier and other traders having to do that on the spot as they're moving from culture to culture. How many pearls for how many diamonds and so on.
I especially enjoyed your description of a typical transaction in Golconda, the legendary city of, is it a city of gold or city of diamonds?
That was really the trade area, yeah.
Yes. And describe to our listeners, a buyer and seller sitting across from each other, how a transaction would be done.
Well, typically if Tavernier came into the market in Golconda, which was the name of the capital city where the diamonds, most of the diamond mines were, and you would sit down, the diamond seller would put these diamonds on basically a black rock set in the ground and display a diamond. And then basically these two guys, the buyer and the seller, would stick their hands under the sleeve of each other and use their fingers as code so that other people would not see the price. And they'd use, you know, kind of one finger or a squeeze at the elbow, and that would mean 1,000 rupees. They'd use fingers on their wrists or hands. And so they use this intricate code to negotiate diamonds so other people would not know the exact price they were paying. You can think of that almost like what happens in the New York Stock Exchange or in the commodity markets today, where if you're looking from the outside, you have all sorts of people using hand signals and other things to negotiate and to trade stocks. And if you're an outsider, you have no idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Something else you mentioned in this early chapter is the way in which the Indians viewed these kind of precious gems. You talk about how they saw them as possessing sort of special powers of strength and protection, that kings and queens needed gems to help them rule effectively and not be overcome by evil forces. So for them, it was not a matter of ostentation, of wearing a gem because it shows how rich you are. It had nothing to do with that, or not much to do with that.
Yeah, as one you know, jeweler, you know, told me in an interview, these gems were used by Indian gods and goddesses, kings and queens, as almost protection. The idea is that gems, shiny rocks found in the earth, actually are bits of fallen stars and planets from above. And when you wear them, they basically have the power almost to suck in bad stuff and absorb it. And so it's almost a protection. It's almost an amulet of protection against bad stuff in the universe. And, of course, gods that are called the Shining Ones, and kings and queens often take on that appellation too, the idea is that it sucks in the bad stuff and shines out the good stuff. Think of it as almost a Pandora's box that absorbs all the evil and all the bad stuff in society. And of course, I think what happens with the thinking about the curse is as gems travel back to the West, what do people in the West do? Well, during the Renaissance, they develop a sense of optics. They develop a sense of light coming out. And so they start cutting these diamonds in very geometric ways that the stuff shines out. And so all the bad stuff accumulated in these gems in the East is all of a sudden let out, and it shines in the West. And I think that's the kind of underlying logic of the curse. When you read about things in by the 20th century in the United States and in Europe, the idea is that these gems from India have baleful and woeful influences. There's a light inside that's let loose on society. And so the Pandora's box of all the evils that have accumulated in the East are then let loose in the West. And I think that's the underlying logic of the curse.
One other thing which I thought was kind of interesting, as you mentioned, the value placed on diamonds by various cultures. I remember you writing about the Romans and how they also valued diamonds, but not for the reason that the Indians did and not in the way that Europeans later did, but just the fact that they so admired admired diamonds for their strength, for the fact that they were such a tremendously hard, unyielding surface.
Well, I think people discovered that early on, that diamonds were very rare because they were so hard. And the Romans actually, you know, did, because they were getting diamonds from India, and I think they were attuned to one of the Indian uses of diamonds, did not cut them either. Because the cutting of diamonds really doesn't get started till the Renaissance. So the Romans also used these diamonds as protections from the evil eye, you know, and the idea that I think they provided some protection. And we know through the Middle Ages, diamonds really weren't cut in Europe. It was really the Renaissance where people applied the sense of optics and light. The notion of enlightened rulers and rulers standing for the sun. You think of Louis XIV as the Sun King, and the idea, you know, let these diamonds shine just like my kingdom shines, like my presence shines. So,
of course, things don't turn out quite so well for instance, Marie Antoinette and others associated with the Hope Diamond, which raises another question for you as a historian. When we are talking about, first of all, such a long history told and retold by so many people, how does one pick between the facts and the fiction, between the real history and the stuff of legend? Tell us about that challenge for you in trying to come to a better understanding of this long history.
Well, that's why it took me 13 years to write the book. and I hope that 13 doesn't have any bad luck associated with it. But it took a lot. I mean, I had to travel to India several times, really looking through archives and records in France, in Russia, in Switzerland, in England, even in the dusty old archives of the attic of the Smithsonian, to really try to get a handle on separating out truth from fiction. And as you pointed out, you know, this did become instant folklore, and if you go on the web or you go to these other things, sometimes things are repeated so much that they seem to take on a life of their own. And the Hope Diamond, in some respects, was a very early, what we call urban legend. And it really acquired its power because things were associated in, printed in the newspapers, subject of film and documentary films and so on, and I really had to get down to primary sources, primary records, scientific evidence, and so on. And while there's still some speculation, and I end the book with a series of 21 questions about things that have to be examined even further, and there may be your listeners out there that have pieces of information or access to it that will help us on that treasure hunt for the real facts, nevertheless, it really requires tracking down the leads, almost like a history detective.
Richard Curran, on the staff of the Smithsonian Institution and the author of this really interesting book called The Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem.
published by the Smithsonian. Tomorrow on the morning show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, pays his monthly visit to the program. Nan Calvert is back with an environmentally themed program on Thursday. And on Friday, we replay the last morning show conversation with former UW Parkside Chancellor, Dr. Jack Keating. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.